The North Carolina Reading Service supplies this program for our audience of blind or print-impaired listeners. It's the Indie Week, independent, read by John Federson, and the date of publication for this, February the 26th of 2026. And off we go. Most Whig Democratic delegates vote to keep the chair amid calls for his removal. That is Wesley Knott, and he will continue to serve as chair of the Wake County Democratic Party, WCDP, following a successful vote of confidence in his leadership at Saturday's county party convention. Some Wake Democrats called for his resignation last week based on his decision to endorse Nida Alam in the recent competitive primary for North Carolina's 4th Congressional District. Knott called the vote of confidence himself and said he would resign if it failed. 74% of the delegates at the convention voted for him to continue, either because they supported his decision to endorse Alam or just didn't think it was worth firing him. Well, Knott endorsed Alam over incumbent Valerie Fouché in December, bucking the tradition of party chairs staying neutral in primaries. He went on to appear in a campaign advertisement for Alam that was critical of Fouché, speak in support of Alam at a rally headlined by Bernie Sanders, post about Alam on his personal social media, and author an op-ed in the Duke Chronicle that praised Alam and suggested Fouché as corrupt. Knott was identified as the local party chair at the rally, in the op-ed, and on his social media account. Fouché ran that race by a narrow margin. Two complaints were filed last week to the NCDP calling for his removal, claiming his endorsement and campaign activities violated NCDP rules. Knott says he expects both complaints, quote, will be found to be meritless. The Council of Review, a special statewide committee, will make that final determination. The vote of confidence is separate from two petitions seeking his ouster, but suggests he could weather removal procedures. Knott's naysayers argued he abused his visibility and authority as WCDP chair to unfairly elevate one primary candidate over the other. Though Knott endorsed Alam personally and not on the party's behalf, they claimed the line is too blurry, since he is the party's face and voice in Wake County. Other critics were offended by his negative comments about Fouché, a black woman incumbent with decades of experience in public service and a progressive voting record. He said during this convention, which was held on Zoom and streamed on YouTube, "I know there are a lot of people in that 74% that disagree very strongly with the decisions that I made. Let me just say how moving it is for me to for you to trust my continued leadership. I recognize it not as a vote of agreement in all my decisions, but in your trust for us to be able to turn the page together." He added, quote, "There's a lot of work to do to repair a lot of trust, to build and strengthen a lot of relationships with the people he wanted him to resign. I'm committed to doing that work," he said, "but I'm very excited to turn the page with you all in November. We've got a lot of elections to win." Last year was a successful one for the WCDP. Democrats won 33 out of 34 municipal elections in Wake County, including in the county's more conservative suburbs. During the convention, Knott announced the party's get-out-the-vote efforts, canvassing, phone banks, robocalls, text reminders, and more than doubled turnout among low-propensity Democratic and left-leaning voters. He said, "Every election that was decided by fewer than 400 or 500 votes, we made the difference on. We are the wave." This year, of course, the Whig Dems are working to get Roy Cooper elected to the U.S. Senate, Anita Earls re-elected to the state Supreme Court, and Democrats elected in the state legislature. Next, devastating anticipated cuts to special education raise alarms in Wake County. Wake County Public Schools, WCPSS, is compiling what district officials are calling perhaps one of the most challenging budgets to prepare in the past 20 years. For the coming academic year, and $18 million worth of special education funding is on the chopping block. WCPSS would eliminate about 130 special ed teacher positions next school year, according to an email to staff last week by Lisa Allred, the Assistant Superintendent for Special Education Services. Since WCPSS currently has 1,400 special ed teachers, according to a district spokesperson, Lisa Luton, that translates to a 9% reduction in force. The cuts would affect cross-categorical resource special ed teachers who do not teach within a single classroom, but instead support special ed students and implement their individual education plans, or IEPs, school-wide. Laura Huntington, a special ed instructional assistant at Carver Elementary in Wendell, told Indy last week, "I think this would be devastating. All of our classrooms have been strained to the breaking point, but especially our special ed classrooms. Cutting these positions isn't going to eliminate the needs of the students. It's just going to displace them into the already overwhelmed classrooms that cannot meet their needs." In addition to herself, Huntington's pre-K classroom has one teacher and 18 students, about half of whom have IEPs. That's the individual programs designed for them, and receive special ed services, meaning they may have learning or developmental disabilities or be on the autism spectrum. Huntington and the teacher she works with are specially trained to support those students' needs. When one or a few students in her classroom need personal attention, the rest of the class can easily get out of hand. Recently, during a particularly difficult moment where one student was kicking, punching, and, quote, tearing up the classroom, she called for extra support on her school's walkie-talkie system, but nobody responded. She said, "We were already stretched so thin, the people who were available to help were already dealing with other issues in the school, with other students. Making cuts is the exact opposite of what needs to be done." WCPSS knows the need for special educators is growing. Luton wrote in an email to Indy, "Over the past several years, more students are receiving special ed services, and more of those students need additional support, specialized staff, or services outside their school." According to Luton, WCPSS has for several years been using federal carryover funds, leftover unobligated grant money from past budget cycles, to cover rising special ed costs. Those funds have now run out. Meanwhile, other expenses within the special ed department, including health insurance costs and state-mandated salary increases, have gone up. The special ed budget cuts aren't happening in a vacuum. WCPSS Chief Operating Officer David Neter, N-E-T-E-R, reminded the school board last week that ongoing federal funding for public education is uncertain, and North Carolina still does not have a budget. Meanwhile, the school system's operating costs, insurance premiums, and the share of funding for charter schools are all rising. Because of all the uncertainty and cost increases, next year's school's budget probably will not include any funding for new programs or expansions of existing ones. Nader said WCPSS expects to ask Wake County for an additional $25 million in funding for the next year's budget, even though the district's need is, quote, far in excess of that $25 million. The county has routinely increased the district's budget by about $50 million annually for the past several years. Nader said WCPSS is not asking for the full amount it says it needs, in part, quote, based on what is projected to be the county's capacity to fund. noting Wake County has lowered its property tax revenue projections for next year. Christina Cole, president of the Wake County chapter of the North Carolina Association of Educators, that's the Wake NCAE, and a special ed teacher, called the cuts to special education absolutely unacceptable. She said in a Facebook Live after the school board meeting last week, when the state and federal government are proposing cuts, it's a responsibility of the county to generate revenue to fund our public schools. Wake NCAE's number one ask to the district this budget cycle was for more special ed funding, more behavioral support positions per school, higher pay for educators, and lower caseloads. The union polled its members, found that funding increases for special ed was their top priority. It also calculated that a 0.01% property tax increase would pay for 200-plus new hires, a $200 monthly pay raise for special educators, and more. According to Cole, since November, Wake NCAE has gathered over 2,000 petition signatures and met with 6 out of 9 school board members, Taylor and Allred, in support of its special ed campaign. The union, along with WCPSS parents and students, organized protests outside several schools around the district last week to protest the planned cuts and call on District Superintendent Robert Taylor to reverse course before he presents his budget proposal to the school board on April the 7th. In response to the public outcry, school board chair Tyler Swanson called a special board meeting for Tuesday to continue discussing the special ed budget. For nearly 5 hours, the Wake County School Board grilled Superintendent Taylor and his staff about the plan. In a rare display of unity for a board that often cleaves around partisan lines, every member expressed opposition to the proposed cuts. Swanson declared, "I am not in favor of balancing budget on the backs of our most vulnerable students." Top district staff sat at a long table beneath the board's dais as if they were testifying at a hearing. Board members took turns questioning and berating them. Why did the board receive inconsistent, incomplete information about the special ed budget for months? Why did the district notify teachers of impending layoffs before the annual budget was even approved? Why didn't staff sound the alarm about dwindling federal grant funds until March, when they knew about the problem in the fall? Board member Sam Hershey said, "We should have been talking about this for the last 6 or 7 months." Multiple board members asked district staff if they had taken time to hear from the special ed teachers at risk of losing their jobs. They hadn't. Board member Toshiba Rice pondered out loud the possibility of making a motion to fire Taylor, and she wasn't the only one who made her displeasure known. Board member Chris Hagerty said, "I don't think the solutions that were offered here really reflect an understanding of staff and family needs." He added, "This wasn't the first incident of poor communication between district staff and the board." He urged the superintendent, "You have to get a handle on this. This is unacceptable." Swanson said he'd received hundreds, if not thousands, of concerned emails about the proposed cuts and indicated he would not support a budget proposal that included them. To make up the $18 million, he suggested reducing non-academic roles like central office staff or assistant principals. Luton told Indy WCPSS has enough teacher turnover each year that the district expects to be able to place most of the laid-off special ed teachers into other newly vacant positions at the end of this school year. Quote, "We expect to be able to keep all the special ed teachers who are on continuing contracts and many of those that are on terminating contracts." Part of the reasons Allred notified special ed staff of the cuts ahead of Taylor unveiling his budget is so teachers can apply to to vacant positions as they open. Allred's email said special ed teacher ratios, quote, would remain within or below state recommended ranges after the cuts. North Carolina recommends that public school districts maintain ratios of no more than 35 elementary students and no more than 50 middle or high school students per cross-categorical resource special education teacher. Currently, WCPS ratios are 1 to 20 in elementary schools, 1 to 24 in middle schools, and 1 to 37 in high schools, Luton told the Indy. Next year, after the cuts, those ratios will be 1 to 25 for elementary, 1 to 30 in middle, 1 to 40 in high school. The state's recommendations help ensure special ed students receive the additional support outlined in their IEPs, which are legally binding documents. Luton stressed that after the cuts, students, quote, will continue to receive all services outlined in their IEPs. Huntington, the special education instructional assistant, is not so sure. She said, I think the reality is that it's going to be very difficult for students to receive the services that they need. Next, over to the town of Apex. Apex is well positioned to attract large businesses but faces headwinds, say experts. As Apex town council members discussed the town's economic future, some lamented the state's budget deadlock. Negotiations in the General Assembly have been stalled since July of last year with no end in sight, despite the budget now being more than 8 months overdue. Councilmember Shane Reese said Tuesday, toward the end of a nearly four-hour work session on economic development, a state budget would be great. And I joke, but only half, because that offers us a stability that allows us to move forward. Ironically, one of the factors that had been holding up the state budget was a recent big economic victory for the town, the new North Carolina Children's Hospital to be built at the intersection of US 1 and NC 540. This hospital, which will be the second largest in the country when completed, will engage in research and education backed by Duke and UNC Health. State senators originally asked for an additional $638 million in the budget to support the project, but drastically cut back that ask after talks with the House stalled. The hospital is expected to bring nearly 8,000 jobs to Apex and Wake County. When it comes to growth, there's a long list of things Apex is doing right, according to East Carolina University economic development experts Charles Hayes and Don Parks, who presented to council members during the work session. But there are also major economic headwinds that are impacting cities and towns across the country. Even something as simple as uncertainty in how government regulations might change, how much public money will be available, can discourage businesses from hiring or expanding. When it comes to attracting, retaining, and growing business in Apex, officials have learned not to count on the state and federal funding that was previously more dependable. Government instability was mentioned more than once as a concerning trend the town would need to find a way to deal with. President Trump's 2025 funding cuts to the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, and the National Institutes for Health, NIH, among others, resulted in widespread layoffs across the triangle among residents who worked for those agencies or places that benefited from their grants and contracts, especially at nearby Research Triangle Park. Since Trump made those cuts, Hayes estimated the region has lost $300 million in research funding and, as a result, 9 to 12 jobs for each $1 million, about 3,000 jobs. Trump's tariffs have made it difficult for many industries to engage in the global trade they need to do business. While his dismantling of EPA and NIH have undermined environmental protection, healthcare research, and green energy. Councilmember Edward Gray said, "A lot of the grants and funding, maybe even the regulatory backbone we were looking for at the federal or state level, have been rolled back. We find ourselves trying to figure out how we can maintain regional, multi-governmental partnerships with, say, our county or other local municipalities in order to help fill that gap." According to Hayes and Parks, Apex Town Council members should also be concerned about the impact of advanced technology and artificial intelligence on jobs. Parks said, "Manufacturing is yielding less jobs than we ever thought it would. The company's initial promise of 500 new jobs could later decrease to 200 as automation and robotics take over tasks previously performed by employees. We've moved a long way from the Industrial Revolution," said Park, "so when we think about future jobs and making choices on what we're trying to attract, this is an element. What will be there in terms of manufacturing, distribution?" As technology advances, however, Apex hopes to capitalize on emerging industries. According to the town's Economic Development Director, Joanna Helms, staff are hoping to attract businesses involved in advanced manufacturing, information technology, life sciences, and clean technology, as well as entrepreneurs. Towns across the country are seeing job loss from AI, but the most recent debate in Apex was over how a proposed data center would affect quality of life. "And that's also a key factor in economic competitiveness," said Barks. Apex's long list of accolades, one of the best small cities in America, etc., is among its most notable characteristics when it comes to attracting potential employers and employees. Quality of life, said Parks, is sometimes overlooked in economic development strategies we see, but for a place like Apex, it is a key distinguishing characteristic. Town council members discussed a wide variety of concerns during the work session, touching on established worries about the sustainability of rapid growth, the need to protect the Apex's small town feel, housing affordability, the local job market, and challenges facing small businesses. Looking to the future, staff and council members talked about the need to continue building up infrastructure, including preparation of specific sites for industrial development. Staff members also discussed the need for more commercial real estate, given Apex's low vacancy rate. Helms mentioned that one of the reasons Apex has lost out on big projects to neighboring towns is it lacks large tracts of land for sale. While businesses might be able to build a new facility, they won't own the land. Helms said, "This is why Holly Springs has a lot of life science and we don't, because they had hundreds of acres of land for sale." Council members and staff also talked about the need to continue recruiting a diverse mix of businesses so the town can withstand economic downturns. In addition, some said, Apex should look at attracting businesses that support major industries like financial services and suppliers. Ultimately, though, the meeting ended with a conversation about reckoning with Apex's success. The town is in a strong place when it comes to getting large business to invest in the area. Life science company, Apiject, announced in January it would open a new manufacturing facility in Apex, bringing more than 100 new jobs, according to Helms. Construction workers also recently broke ground for the first building at Veridia, a 1,200-acre sustainable mixed-use development and future home of that North Carolina Children's Hospital. The question is how to reconcile that growth with residents' concerns and, in some cases, coordinated pushback. Gray said, we recognize if you create growth, we're going to get a little bit of that residential resistance. Folks don't like growth. So it's a messaging problem for us. How we're going to convince the residents here that change isn't bad, that we are building in the infrastructure necessary to support that sort of growth, whether that's roadways, sewers, land spacing, addressing the affordability issues so that we can attract the right workers. All right, well, two articles now in the Indie Week about residences, where to live, how to afford it, etc. Let's go to Chatham Estates. They have only 3 months left to find new homes, and residents of Chatham Estates Mobile Home Park in Kerry are demanding that companies with plans to redevelop the property contribute $2 million to an ongoing relocation effort. The property, home to more than 700 people, was put up for sale in 2023 by owner Curtis Westbrook Sr. Then, in January of this year, families got the news they were dreading, a notice to vacate by June 30. Although Chatham Estates was still owned by Westbrook as of this story, quote, Carrie's understanding is the Toll Brothers and the current property owner intend on closing the sale in June of this year, read a staff report. A proposal to redevelop the site was initially submitted last year by a civil engineering firm, quote, on behalf of Toll Brothers, according to the report. The proposal, also associated with real estate investment firm Kennedy Wilson, is currently under review by town staff and shows plans to build 330 new multifamily units and 97 new townhomes on the site. None of those are likely to be within the price range of Chatham Estates families, most of whom are currently paying about $400 a month to rent the land their mobile homes occupy. At two Toll Brothers communities outside I-540, one in Morrisville and one in Apex, single-family homes start at $1.4 million. $1.4 million. Residents held a press conference Saturday to call on the developers to help families being displaced and ask for donations to a relocation fund managed by the nonprofit Neighbor Up. Chatham Estates resident Abigail Dawa said, we are here today to say our lives are not only construction debris. If Toll Brothers can afford to build million-dollar houses, they can afford to make sure they don't leave about 600 people homeless in the process. To a billion-dollar developer like Toll Brothers, $2 million is like pocket change, she added. To us, this money is the difference between a future and a complete disaster. It's the cost of moving our homes, security, keeping our children in their schools, in their neighborhood, with their friends. The Chatham States Neighborhood Association, led by Dawa and other residents, is also demanding a face-to-face meeting with the developers or their legal representatives who have yet to communicate directly with residents. They are also asking the developers to build new affordable housing on the site. Parentheses, the Indy reached out to Toll Brothers for comment. Moving, already a difficult process, is nearly impossible for Chatham Estates families. Many would like to move their mobile homes, which they've poured money into renovating and improving. But the majority of the homes are too old to move, and the cost of moving newer homes is around $15,000 to $25,000. The other option, finding a new apartment or home to rent and carry, is just as difficult. From 2020 to 2024, the median rent for Kerry was $1,800. At the press conference, some 40 families, mostly Latino and working class, pleaded for help in Spanish. Accompanied by their children, several people broke down in tears as they described being forced to leave the neighborhood where they have raised their children and enjoyed a sense of safety. Emidia Rublero, in a speech that was translated into English, said, quote, "We keep going on with our lives, continuing to work, taking the children to school, doing the shopping, going to church, but we also carry the added pressure of finding a new place to live. Those of us who can't move our homes will lose everything we have invested, the money we used to buy them and what we spent on improvements. Our neighborhood will be gone and our sense of community gone with it." 17-year-old Lady Diaz Morales, who has lived in the community for 7 years and attends Cary High School, said at the press conference, "Some residents face losing jobs nearby when they have to move away." She said, "This situation, it's not only our household, it's our financial stability. Our lives are here in Cary, it's our home. It's very painful to think about having to leave it." In an effort to help Chatham Estates families, the Cary Town Council created a new fund in 2024, dubbed Stable Homes Cary. Nonprofit Neighbor Up has been charged with managing the fund under the direction of Andy Curry, Senior Director of Community Services. Curry said that all $800,000 currently in the fund will be used to help Chatham Estates residents with moving costs, including paying security deposit and for the first month of rent, but with 144 families in need, it is not enough. Cary Town Council member Michelle Craig, who represents District B and Chatham Estates, said at this press conference, "The news the mobile home park was going to be redeveloped was devastating. There is nothing we can do at this point to make those families whole. There's nothing we could do to make it okay. This is not going to be okay," she added, her voice breaking. "We need the community to step up," said Craig. "There are almost 200,000 people in Cary. If we all could give $1, that would bring $800,000 up to $1 million. Carissa Cohn Johnson, an at-large town council member who lives only a few blocks away from Chatham Estates, also entreated Cary residents to donate to the relocation effort, saying, "I grew up in a mobile home community. I ask that anybody here in Cary who grew up without much and now has a lot to remember what that felt like. Go out and donate. If you can do $20, that's fantastic. But a lot of us are doing a heck of a lot better, and we can do better than that." As of Monday, Neighbor Up had raised about $28,000, a fraction of its $250,000 goal. Here is how to donate, closes this article. Visit neighborup.org. That's NEIGHBORUP, neighborup.org/Chatham States. Chatham Estates. CHATHAMESTATES. So neighborup.org/, Chatham Estates. Over to Durham, which aims for affordable housing on the old police headquarters site. After 10 years and many fits and starts, the Durham City Council has a plan for bringing affordable housing to the site of the former police headquarters in downtown Durham. At the March 19th work session, the City Council received a presentation that offered two possible scenarios. Both of them include building 80 units of affordable housing on a portion of the 505 West Chapel Hill Street site using the competitive 9% low-income housing tax credit from the federal government, which the city would have to apply for and win. The units would be available for folks earning at or below 60% of the area median income. That's AAMI. 60%. The main difference between the two plans stems from where to construct the parking. The first scenario suggests an 80-space surface parking lot adjacent to a newly constructed building. The second, preferred by a majority of the City Council, suggests building 5 stories of housing on top of 2 floors of structured parking. The latter plan would increase the necessary funding needed for the project, but ultimately, the structured parking would save the city money by allowing it to use the remainder of the property in a more productive manner. Councilmember Carl Rist said, I want to note the requirement for parking is not a City of Durham requirement. That comes from the North Carolina Housing Finance Agency. We eliminated parking minimums for the reasons we're talking about here. We don't want to take high-value land in the middle of the city and encumber it with parking. The six-member working group that delivered this presentation, composed of local residents with expertise in housing, suggested Scenario 2, with the developer receiving a long-term ground lease at a nominal cost from the city. Building housing on top of structured parking could allow for an additional affordable housing development with 55 more units on the site in the future. But to create any momentum for the project, the working group insisted the city move quickly to select a developer, quote, with a proven track record in Durham, by this July, to develop a plan for the first phase of the site. Greg Warren, former president of DHIC and a board member of Raleigh Housing Authority, had this to say, we're concerned that if you did some sort of formal RFP or RFQ process, you wouldn't have sufficient time to really undertake that and still have a developer with enough decision time to submit an application in January. So that's why we're really pressing for the July timeframe. Advocates have been pining for affordable housing on the site for nearly a decade, since 2018, after the council identified affordable housing as its highest priority for the site, staff has churned through development plans amid poor market conditions and rising construction costs. The Peebles Company, a development firm with a national portfolio, mutually agreed with the city to end its recent attempt at a site plan in June. At a work session in December, the city council organized the working group and tasked them with delivering a path forward. Well, council members were pleased to have a viable option that included much-needed affordable units at that meeting March 19th. Chelsea Cook, council member, quote, I'm sitting up here feeling really good in a way I actually haven't felt about this project since I've been on this council. In addition to building affordable housing, folks have encouraged the city council to preserve the former police headquarters, which was designed by noted modernist architect Milton Small. To do so, the city would subdivide the property and sell that building to Preservation North Carolina for rehabilitation. And now rehabbing the building is estimated to cost at least $25 to $30 million, according to Mark Kubasik, director of Community Development Company, HR&A, who made a presentation at December 4th meeting. Plans for that Milton small building could include additional market rate or affordable housing, a hotel, or an office. While the newest plan was welcomed by many on council, as well as others who spoke at Thursday's meeting, not everyone was completely satisfied with the available options. The proposal for the overall site is mostly focused on housing and amenities, like a playground and outdoor green space. City councilors and folks from the working group discussed the possibility of street-level retail that would be accessible to the public and expand the growing offerings along the Chapel Hill Street corridor into downtown, but given the parameters of the current affordable housing proposal, retail would be difficult to include. Ann Branley, Chief Operating Officer at Downtown Durham, Inc., read remarks on behalf of DDI CEO Nicole Thompson, asking the City Council to take a broader look at how the future of former police headquarters would interact with the long-term vision for the greater downtown area, and whether this current plan would keep fidelity with the Downtown Durham, Inc. master plan. Branley said, quote, we recognize the need to expand affordability and also believe further dividing the site without considering all the interconnected factors will make it difficult to realize its full potential. you are in a unique position to ensure that what happens at this important location continues to fuel downtown Durham's growth and vibrancy. The site serves as a gateway and is located near several other development opportunities. Mayor Pro Tem Javier Caballero echoed concerns that focusing solely on housing does not line up with adopted plans for downtown or maximize property tax revenue from the site, saying, "We've talked a lot about keeping people downtown, having people have a full life full of amenities with the goals of a 15-minute city. I think when you put a lot of residential potential right next to a road, people are just going to get in their cars and drive away, and that does not necessarily help. On a site this large, in the middle of downtown, giving everyone what they want will be an uphill battle." Councilmember Matt Kopeck says there is a risk we have seen borne out over the last 10 years of trying to do things that reflect every single value we have that we want to put on one site as a council and a city. So we may not have every value reflected on this site, but we've been shown there is a path to have affordable housing, to preserve Milton's small building, to be able to have future redevelopment options, to really fully activate the space in a signature way once marketing conditions allow. City staff is set to bring options for possible developers and a more thorough plan for the site before the July deadline suggested by the working group. Then the developer will have until January to submit an application for the Federal Tax Credit Program. Boy, that is a timetable, I'll tell you. All right, so much for that. Well, I have a rare opportunity, based on most of my broadcasts here for Indie Week, that's to devote a considerable portion of the broadcast to some cultural things. And here's one about the North Carolina Opera. It's beating the odds. For about 3 hours on the night of January 30th, Raleigh Memorial Auditorium transformed into Nagasaki at the dawn of the 20th century. Singing Cho-Cho-San in Puccini's Madama Butterfly, Caitlin Godomer watched the harbor for a certain ship, her hope suspended like the cherry blossoms raining down on the stage. But the audience knew the ship would only bring ruin. The moment when Cho-Cho-San's dream dies is one of the most devastating in opera. And this was a polished production helmed by Francesca Zambillo, the artistic director of the Washington National Opera. But great operas struggle to find audiences all the time. So none of this fully accounts for the North Carolina Opera's recent success. NC Opera is one of about 119 professional opera companies in the U.S., according to Opera America's 2025 field report, which was based on surveys of thousands of opera goers and data from hundreds of professionals. And it seems to be markedly outpacing the industry's recovery since COVID. Nationally, houses are typically filling half to three-quarters of seats, and ticket sales still generate less revenue than before the pandemic. But NC Opera's Madama Butterfly was a full sellout and the best-selling show in the nonprofit opera company's 16-year history. It was on track to be its most profitable until one show got snowed out. More important for a sustainable future, the subscriber base has doubled since the 2019 season. Eric Michko, who's been the company's general director since 2010, when the Opera Company of North Carolina and Capital Opera Raleigh merged to form NC Opera, Eric Michko said, "You talk to people around the country in the performing arts and they'll say the subscription model is dead. We haven't found that to be the case." COVID shutdown ravaged all the performing arts, but opera had some unique vulnerabilities. It was an art form defined by unamplified singers expelling prodigious breath in close proximity, a 400-year-old distinctly European art form whose relatability to modern Americans was already up for debate. When the country reopened, opera companies found out which patrons had been habitual and which cared enough to return. They also got a small but significant influx of first-time visitors and new subscribers. The question was whether the newcomers were just giving opera a whirl, like theatrical sourdough, or could be convinced to stick around. The Opera America Field Report points to several encouraging signs nationally. More than 2 million Americans attend the opera each year, and the field employs about 45,000 people. Ticket revenue per seat has almost rebounded to the pre-pandemic levels, but attendance has yet to fully recover. The overall number of performances has shrunk, and inflation keeps increasing pressure on philanthropic donations, which most operas heavily rely on to survive. Michiko has a straightforward mindset about the company's success. Quote, "It's a matter of doing things that people want to see, right? New audiences like the same things old ones do, the inherited repertoire. It's theater with really great music and people like that. It's a great night out in public to see a show." But the question remains, in content-rich 2026, what compels more than 2,000 people to spend a Friday night immersed in a tragic tale of a young Japanese geisha betrayed by an American naval officer, sung in Italian with English supertitles, and what keeps them coming back? The relevance of the opera was in the news recently after the actor Timothy Chalamet, during a spate of almost impressive insufferableness, proclaimed no one cared about it anymore. Sheer numbers prove him wrong, but the challenges that modernity poses to opera should not be underestimated. Operas cannot do quantity and speed. As NC Opera Director of Marketing Angela Grant pointed out, the difference between a 3-show season and a 4-show season can be hundreds of thousands of dollars. The subscription model clashes with self-curated times, and the expense of each production makes offering the flexibility the consumers want a gamble. The Opera America study focused on, in particular on that small but prized slice of opera newcomers, the majority of whom discovered opera through videos and recordings, rather than the traditional route of growing up in a family that attended. But the live acoustic properties of opera are intrinsic to its power. You can chop it up on reels, but as Will Durant said of philosophy, when dismembered, it loses its beauty and joy. Grant joined NC Opera's small team as its marketing director when the pandemic rebound began in 21. And she said, "I think opera hasn't in the past been as ingrained in our community as it is in bigger cities. Having grown up here, I knew there was opera, but I didn't think of it as something for me to do." Opera did used to seem abstract and remote, you know, something from Bugs Bunny cartoons and jokes about fat ladies singing. But the triangle has evolved culturally, with the influx of people from major metropolises widening local opera's potential audience. And musical theater, from Glee to Wicked to Hamilton, has been a resurgent in 21st century pop culture, peeling a layer of strangeness from the idea of stories in song. The Opera America study found that new audiences are primarily seeking big experiences woven into a broader social fabric, the centerpiece of a night out. They prefer works they've heard of, but this means contemporary fare like The Handmaid's Tale, as much as classics like La Boheme, and they want to understand what they're seeing. Grant said, "I won't lie, not every story is like, no, I can really relate to that character." So we talk about the experience as an audience member. This is your granddaughter's first time at the theater. Her eyes light up when she sees Cinderella on the stage. Or this is your cultural date night out. You get a cocktail in downtown Raleigh and come take pictures under the chandelier. NC Opera also uses edutainment events to make opera more relatable. Madame Butterfly had a sake tasting at the Raleigh Wine School Vitis House, while the April production of Verdi's Il Trovatore will have a metalwork class at Shop Space, playing off the opera's anvil chorus. Pardon me. These enticements get new people in the door, and perhaps half of them will come back next season. I'm just, sorry folks, I'm considering the hangover for the anvil chorus after the experience with cocktails. The enticements get new people in the door, and perhaps half of them will come back next season. That sliver of territory where opera stakes out its stubborn gains. Grant said the performing arts model for nonprofits in regional areas is hard. You have to be fundraising so much because no matter what you do, the tickets are not going to pay for the shows. In opera, it can be, we've always done this, or this is what people expect. But Eric Misko listens to the audience and staff and artists, and he adapts. I think that has allowed us to be more nimble, to move with what's working now. Katie Bridges is one of those vaunted new subscribers. She didn't grow up with live opera. Her first experience of it was while studying in Italy via North Carolina State, stumbling into a low-budget La Traviata in a Venetian palazzo. Everybody was casually dressed, she said, and it wasn't like a big, beautiful production, but the music was just soul-grabbing. Now, she works as a mental health therapist and finds opera's stories of abundant humanity healing. When she became a subscriber in 25, she bought two seats so she could bring along friends, and she enjoys seeing the connections they make. At 37, she's a noticeably youthful presence in Memorial Auditorium. She says, my husband doesn't love the opera, but he loves metal music. When I brought him, he was like, okay, I get why you like this. The way the notes resonate is very similar. I grew up in theater and married my stage manager. So he's enjoying from the perspective of set work and things like that. And she didn't find the story of Madama Butterfly too strange at all. A lot of the themes are relevant today, she said. The way people are treated, the way we view other people, the way that we feel entitled to things. I think that was a powerful story to tell right now. NC Opera's success with the classics allows it to take calculated risks on newer or more obscure work, whether it's Mexican composer Daniel Catán's Florencia en el Amazonas or Jules Massenet's dreamy French Cinderella. Grant said, Eric's programming is a really nice balance of what's artistically exciting and what's going to bring people in the door. He doesn't get caught up in the artistic ego trap of, I don't want to appeal to the masses. When we program something like Florencia en el Amazonas, a newer work by opera standards written in the 1990s, Spanish language, it's beautiful, beautiful music, one of the best things we've ever put on stage, but it didn't sell as well because people don't know the title or story. Eric knew that it wouldn't, and didn't get into saying, we have to make X number of dollars. Growth for the sake of growth is not the point. Grant continued, we don't have a large budget, so I can't go paste the opera on the sides of buses all around town. A lot of what I do is opening the door, making sure that you're having the most welcoming, engaging experience possible. It turns out the classics don't need added pizzazz if you can use it to draw people to them. Mishko said, this has been a tradition going on since 1597. It's been passed down from generation to generation. It's been accumulated. So you want to be sure not to lose that stuff. What we can do is make these pieces come to life right now in Raleigh in 2026. Well, I have come to the last 2 minutes of my broadcast. And so the last article says, five shows to see on local stages this spring. I know this is not for everybody, visually speaking, but I'll just summarize these cultural events. From plays and dance to enigmatically hard to categorize works, most local communities bring works to Triangle stages this spring. Starting March 30, 31, April 10, 11th, Carolina Performing Arts at John Gilling Jones Art Space is Eclipse. Artists from Saxapaw-based performing arts collective Culture Mill premiered Eclipse, a participatory, site-specific work exploring the history of the land on which Performing Arts Joan Gilling's Art Space at Current Theater sits and the way history lives on in our bodies. That's March 30, 31, and April 10 and 11. Inspired by Gita Kapoor's To Drink from the Well, the Struggle for Racial Equality at the Nation's Oldest Public University, that production was part dance, part history lesson, part healing ritual, part community practice. Another one, Joan Gilling's, again, Center for Dramatic Art in Chapel Hill, Steel Magnolias, we can all remember that. It's through the film, featuring Julia Roberts, Dolly Parton, Sally Field, Shirley MacLaine. It's better known, it was the stage version that came first. That will be April 8th through the 26th. Next, Lungs, the Justice Theater Project at the Church of the Nativity in Raleigh, April 10 through 26. A nameless couple debates personal responsibility, the nature of humanity, and most pressing for their circumstances, the ethics of raising a child on a dying planet in Duncan McMillan's Lungs. That, again, is a Church of the Nativity in Raleigh, April 10 to 26. Well, and I have to leave out two productions coming up. IndieWeek.com is your online free resource for this periodical that I'm reading. I, being John Fetterson, who now bids you goodbye. And this is a podcast. After the Friday broadcast, it'll be available as a podcast in our library. ncreadingservice.org is that website. And we thank you very much for paying attention to this important periodical. And I will be with you next week for the next edition of Indie Week. Bye-bye.